fully vile, might among man or masons of so vile and perjured a wretch as I, should I knowingly or willfully violate this, my solemn obligation of being a master mason. It's absolutely incredible, really, isn't it? They swear before God to kill themselves if they ever violate this vow to be a Freemason. And you just wonder, don't you? Can't they just say, will you keep your promise to be a Mason? And they receive a simple yes. But mankind will go to unbelievable extremes to try and bind somebody to the truth. And the fact is, all such extremes are predicated on man's basic dishonesty. But I tell you, oaths don't actually change our heart. In fact, sometimes the more passionately a person swears to tell the truth, the more revealing it is about their lack of credibility. Well, the issue of swearing oaths was just as much a part of ancient life as it is for us today. And as a result, some of the Jewish converts that were coming into the early church brought this system of oaths with them. And so James has to deal with that particular issue head on. James chapter 5 and verse 12. I'll read this in the New King James Version. James chapter 5 and verse 12. Where he writes, "But above all, my brethren, do not swear either by heaven or by earth or with any other oath, but let your yes be yes and your no, no, lest you fall into judgment." So James says, stop swearing, stop that system. It's unnecessary, it should be superfluous. Your speech should always be so honest. You should have such integrity and credibility that all people will ever want to hear from you is yes or no. And they wouldn't ask for more than that because they know that your word is your bond. See, that's the way that it ought to be within the church. We have to be different, don't we, from the world around us. We have to be a people whose simple yes means yes and no means no, and that's enough. Now what James is doing, of course, in this verse is to succinctly repeat Jesus' words that we had in the Bible reading over in Matthew 5, beginning in verse 33. Here Jesus says, "Again, you have heard that it was said to the people long ago, do not break your oath, but fulfill to the Lord the vows you have made. But I tell you, do not swear an oath at all, either by heaven, for it is God's throne, or by the earth, for it is God's footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And do not swear by your head, for you cannot make even one hair white or black. And all you need to say is simply yes or no. Anything beyond this, it comes from the evil one." Now these words actually go far beyond the taking of oaths and vows, and they actually deal with the issue of truthful speech. And I think the majority of people would agree that there is a crisis of truth in our culture. Politicians, contractors, estate agents, car salesmen are all notorious for promising things that they know that they can never really deliver. But with every broken promise, distrust increases and the fabric of our society begins to unravel just that little bit more. There is a Christian organization that you may have heard of. It's been specially set up for men, and it's called the Promise Keepers. And the fact that it has attracted thousands of men to its rallies, I think, says something about the need to restore integrity among men. Men who will actually do what they say they're going to do. And it emphasizes a number of things. For example, it says, if we promise that we are to love our wives and be faithful to them until death do us part, then we should keep that promise. If we make a promise to a customer in our business, then we should keep our word even if it costs us. If we promise things to our children, then we should keep our promise. In our everyday communication, we should seek to speak the truth and not shade it with nuances that actually hide the truth. And you see, all of these things are implicit in what James is referring to when he says, as believers, we must be truthful in our communication so that we do not fall under judgment. Now, to understand really where James is coming from here, to understand the words that he is giving to us, we need to understand how the Jews of Jesus' day were using oaths. Oaths ought to foster truthful communication, but in reality, they had become just a facade for lying. Now, you see, the Jews understood what it says in Deuteronomy chapter 6. And verse 13. Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verse 13 says, fear the Lord your God, serve him only, and take your oaths in his name. In other words, what it's saying in Deuteronomy is, if you ever swear an oath, then swear the oath by God's name. So a legitimate Old Testament vow invoked the name of God and the name of God alone. And it was a very serious undertaking. If a person made such a vow, they had to keep it. They couldn't just throw around God's name flippantly. They couldn't invoke the name of God to bind themselves to truthfulness in order to convince someone else that they're telling the truth and then just go ahead and violate that vow. But in knowing that if you were going to use God's name in your oath, you had to keep your word. But the Jews believed that if you swore by some lesser thing, then you're not actually bound to keep your word. Now Jesus confronts that attitude in Matthew chapter 23. Matthew 23, we'll look at verses 16 to 22. Matthew 23, beginning in verse 16. And in verse 16, Jesus says, woe to you, blind guides! You say, if anyone swears by the temple, it means nothing. But anyone who swears by the gold in the temple is bound by that oath. You blind fools! Which is greater, the gold or the temple that makes the gold sacred? You also say, if anyone swears by the altar, it means nothing. But anyone who swears by the gift on the altar is bound by that oath. You blind men! Which is greater, the gift or the altar that makes the gift sacred? Therefore, anyone who swears by the altar swears by it and by everything on it. And anyone who swears by the temple swears by it and by the one who dwells in it. And anyone who swears by heaven swears by God's throne and by the one who sits on it. See, this was the situation and the context behind Jesus' command in the Sermon on the Mount, not to make any oaths at all, but let your statement be yes or no. That was the context in which it was given. It was because oaths were being used in such a way as to convince people that you were genuinely telling the truth, while all the while you knew you weren't, and you weren't going to keep your vow. In other words, the real issue that Jesus was addressing was the speaking of truth at all times. Now, some of the early Jewish converts that were coming into the Jerusalem church that James was pastoring, was bringing in this system into the church. And so James had to address this issue. And so we're going to consider what James says here under four main headings. First of all, we're going to see that believers, you and me, need to work at truthful communication. Then we're going to see that the Bible does not actually prohibit all oaths, but it does restrict them. And then we're going to see that the real issue behind all of this is the truthful communication that we should have. And then fourth, we're going to see that if we engage in boastful, deceptive speech, false oaths, then there is a judgment that we fall under. And we're going to see what that means. So first of all then, believers need to work at truthful communication. Now the importance of what James is saying here comes in the opening words of verse 12, where he says, "But above all, my brethren." Now that takes this particular exhortation out from all of the others that he's been given, and it sets it in its primary place. It's interesting, isn't it, that he says, above all, stop swearing, as if this is the most important thing in the whole epistle that he's telling us. It's a very significant beginning, and it has crucial implications. You see, because this statement that James makes occupies just one verse, just one short paragraph, you know, we could easily read over it, and we could easily think, well, it can't be that important, it's just one verse. And so James waylays that thought by starting off by saying, above all. The meaning in Greek means beyond all other considerations. And we see the importance of what he's saying here. This is a command with priority. This is a command with preeminence. And we shouldn't really be surprised at that, because his command here is related to the matter of speech. And you'll have noticed as we've been working through the book of James that James has dealt with speech in every chapter that we've looked at. James chapter 1 and verse 26. It says, "Those who consider themselves to be religious and yet do not keep a tight rein on their tongues, deceive themselves, and their religion is worthless." Now the word religion here is a term that is used to refer to the outward liturgy. It's the ceremony of religion. And so James is saying, you may go throughout all the outward motions. You may give all of the appearance of being religious. But if you don't bridle your tongue, then there's absolutely no evidence whatsoever that you've changed, that you have a changed heart. James chapter 2 and verse 12. He says, "Speak and act as those who are going to be judged by the law that gives freedom." In other words, if you want to give evidence of your spiritual liberation in Christ, that you now have a transformed life, that you are different because of who and what Christ is and what he has done for you, then it will show in the way that you speak and the way that you act. Then chapter 3 has a very lengthy passage on taming the tongue, which we studied in great detail. James chapter 4 and verse 11. It says, "Brothers and sisters, do not slander one another. Anyone who speaks against a brother or sister or judges them speaks against the law and judges it. When you judge the law, you are not keeping it, but you are sitting in judgment on it." And then we come to chapter 5 and verse 12, where again James refers to our speech. And so it's not surprising then, is it, that he starts this little paragraph by saying, above all things. Because it's of grave concern to James how we speak. Because It's a manifestation of what's in our heart. The way we speak is actually a test that we have living faith. And all throughout this epistle, James has been giving us these tests of whether or not we have a living faith. And one such test is our speech, how we use our tongue. And our speech should reflect and will reflect what's in our heart. And when the Spirit of God has transformed our heart, James is saying there will be honest speech. See, that's the essence of what he's getting at in verse 12. True believers can be tested by their speech. It's a vital part of our spiritual control. In fact, it's an indicator of our spiritual state. So when James uses the phrase above all, it's because he wants us to remember that this is the most revealing physical thing about our spiritual state, how we use our tongue. You see, we sin with our tongue more than in any other way. You can't do everything, but you can actually say anything. And sin is shown more out of our mouth than in any other way. As Jesus said, out of the mouth, the heart speaks. Now, James's use of the phrase here, my brethren, in verse 12, I think is a very encouraging statement, because he says, look, we're all in it together. It's not just I'm looking down on you and saying you've got to sort your language and your tongue out. He's saying, look, I'm with you. You know, I've got to deal with this myself. He doesn't condescend to his readers. Rather, he identifies with them and he has compassion for them, realizing that he's got to guard his tongue and he's got to speak truth himself. And so we're back on a very familiar subject, aren't we, for James? And that is how we use our tongue. And it's a topic that we as Christians need to be exhorted on regularly. See, James isn't speaking to people outside the church here. He's not saying, well, look at all the people out in the world and the bad language that they use. And that you can't trust them. They're all these politicians and estate agents, they never tell the truth. So he's not talking about them. He's talking about believers. He's talking about people inside the church. That's why he's saying, my brethren. See, becoming a Christian doesn't automatically produce truthful communication. And yet, the scriptures are full of telling us that that is what we need to have if we're going to be spiritually mature, if we're going to be growing into the fullness of Jesus Christ. It will reveal itself in the way that we use our tongue. Have a look in Ephesians chapter 4, beginning in verse 14. Ephesians chapter 4, beginning in verse 14. Here Paul says, then we will no longer be infants, tossed back and forth by the waves and blown here and there by every kind of teaching and by the cunning and the craftiness of people in their deceitful scheming. See, we'll no longer be like that, just infants. We need to mature. We need to grow. And how's that going to happen? Well, verse 15 says, instead, speaking the truth in love, we will grow to become, in every respect, the mature body of him who is the head, that is Christ. Now, how are we going to grow to become, in every respect, the mature body of Jesus Christ? It's by speaking the truth in love. Then a few verses later, he writes, verse 25, therefore, each of you must put off falsehood and speak truthfully to your neighbor. For we are all members of one body. We're all in this together. That's why James says, my brethren, all of us need to be considering this. Then the apostle Peter, quoting from Psalm 34, says this in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 10. 1 Peter 3 and verse 10 says, "For whoever would love life and see good days must keep their tongue from evil and their lips from deceitful speech." Begin to see how important this is. Don't assume just because you're a Christian that you're not going to struggle with the sin of being deceptive. We all need to work at truthful communication. That's what James is saying, all of us in this together. We're all members of the same body. We all have these same issues, but we've got to work at it. We've got to look at it. What does the Bible say about taking oaths or making vows? Well, the Bible doesn't prohibit all oaths, but it does restrict them. When James says, "Do not swear," he's not referring to taking the Lord's name in vain. That's not what his subject is here. We know that we are to reverence God. We know that we need to be careful in our use of language so that words like gee or gee whiz or crikey, all of those terms are shortened forms of Jesus Christ. So we need to be careful with the language that we use. But that's not what James is dealing with here. Rather, he's talking about not invoking God's name in everyday speech as a way of trying to assure the truthfulness of what you're saying. You know, someone often says, I swear to God that's true. And, you know, that's all part of what they say regularly. You begin to wonder, actually, if anything that they are saying is true. You see, your words should be true without the need of adding any oath attached to it. But the Bible does teach that there are certain occasions when it's proper to take an oath or to make a vow before God. We've already seen in the Old Testament where Moses says, "Fear the Lord your God, serve him only, and take your oaths in his name." And then God says of the pagan nations in Jeremiah chapter 12 and verse 16. Jeremiah 12 and verse 16. Of the pagan nations around, he says, "And if they learn well the ways of my people and swear by my name, saying, 'As surely as the Lord lives,' even as they once taught my people to swear by Baal, then they will be established among my people." And then over in the New Testament, the only time that Jesus spoke in his trial before the council was when the high priest said this to him. It's recorded in Matthew 26 and verses 63 to 64. Matthew 26, verses 63 to 64. And here the high priest says to Jesus, "I charge you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Messiah, the Son of God." And verse 64, Jesus replied, "You have said so." So Jesus answered under oath. And in fact, if you look through the New Testament, you will be able to see that Paul often swore by the Lord. He often used the phrase, "God is my witness." You can make a note of the references and look them up later. But Romans chapter 1 and verse 9, 2 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 23, Philippians chapter 1 and verse 8, and 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 5 and 10. But perhaps even more significantly, God sometimes swears by himself, either by his words or by enacting his covenant. So over in Hebrews chapter 6, beginning in verse 13. Hebrews 6, beginning in verse 13, this is what we read. When God made his promise to Abraham, since there was no one greater for him to swear by, he swore by himself, saying, I will surely bless you and give you many descendants. And then the author of Hebrews goes on to say this regarding our salvation, down in verse 17, where he writes, because God wanted to make the unchanging nature of his purpose very clear to the heirs of what was promised, he confirmed this with an oath. Now God did this so that by two unchangeable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, we who have fled to take hold of the hope set before us may be greatly encouraged. So as part of that encouragement for us, he confirmed the promise of salvation with an oath. So the Bible does not prohibit all oaths. Rather, what it forbids is frivolous and false oaths. Now, frivolous oaths are those so commonplace that they lose all meaning and they lose all significance. This would include the taking of an oath when it's not proper and it's not necessary. It's a bit like the oath that King Herod swore to the daughter of Herodias, that he would give her up to half of his kingdom because of her dancing before him. It was a frivolous oath. And then when she came up and said, well, actually, I'd like to have John the Baptist's head on a platter, he felt bad, but Herod felt that he had to keep that oath and was unwilling to refuse her. Well, there's the oath that Jephthah made, foolishly vowing to sacrifice the first thing that walked out of his door when he returned from battle. And when it happened to be his only daughter, he foolishly kept that vow. Now, he shouldn't have made it in the first place. It was a frivolous vow, and he certainly shouldn't have carried through with it. But you see, often such frivolous oaths stem from pride. Herod wanted to look good in front of all of his dinner guests, and so he couldn't go back on the oath that he made. Even though he felt bad about killing John the Baptist, he didn't want to lose face. And sometimes I think we can want to impress others with our spiritual commitment and we want to make some sort of boastful oath. But our vows are reserved for the most solemn and the most important occasions so that they really mean something when we say them. So, for example, when we make an oath in court, that's a serious occasion. Or if we vow to be faithful to our mate at our wedding, that's a serious vow. Or if we vow to be faithful to the Lord at our baptism. See, all of those are examples of godly vows that we make. But we need to be careful. We need to be careful when we make a vow. This is what it says in Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verses 4 to 5. Ecclesiastes chapter 5, beginning in verse 4. When you make a vow to God, do not delay to fulfill it. He has no pleasure in fools. Fulfill your vow. It is better not to make a vow than to make one and not fulfill it. You see, we have to consider very carefully if we're going to make a vow, and if we know or we feel we're not going to be able to commit to it and fulfill it, then better not to make it. Now, the other kind of oath that the Bible forbids us to make is a false oath. And a false oath is where the person never intends to keep it. Maybe says it in order to impress or to deceive others. And this is what Jesus and James are really directing their commands toward, these kind of false oaths. You see, the Jews had their elaborate rules that if you swore by the temple, well, you're not bound to keep that oath. But if you swore by the gold of the temple, then you were bound. You know, it's kind of like Tony Banks, the late Labour MP, who, when he was required to take the oath of allegiance to the Queen, that all MPs are required to take if they're going to take up their position in the House of Commons. Well, as he took his oath of allegiance, behind his back he had his fingers crossed. And that really indicated that he didn't mean what he was saying and he had no intention whatsoever of keeping that oath. See, if people just said what they meant and meant what they said, there wouldn't be the need for any of these oaths at all. And the Jews of that day, the early church, were really playing games with each other. But more importantly, they weren't living with integrity in their heart before God. You see, you may be able to fool someone with deceptive or misleading language or a deceptive and misleading contract, you know, where you get someone to sign something and they don't quite understand the small print. But you don't fool God. And He knows the thoughts and the intent of our heart. And if we're practicing deception, the fact that we may have done it all legally, you know, the contract is all set out, that really doesn't matter to God. If in our hearts we're there to deceive. So the Bible doesn't prohibit the taking of all oaths or vows, but it does restrict them, and it restricts them to important occasions. And when we do take an oath, we need to consider it carefully and prayerfully, and we need to be conscientious to see that oath through, to follow through with it. And if we know that we're not going to keep it, if we know that we're not going to fulfill it, then the Scripture tells us it's better not to make that oath in the first place. Now, if after we've made an oath and we're unable to keep our word, then we need to confess that before God. And we need to confess it towards any people that we have wronged as a result of that. And we need to seek to make restitution. We need to be able to restore and heal what has taken place because we've broken our oath, to demonstrate that there's genuine repentance. Okay, here's our third main point then. The real issue behind all of this is truthful communication. Now, in commenting on Matthew chapter 5 and verses 33 to 37, the Bible reading we had at the start, Haddon Robinson, in his book, The Christian Salt and Light Company. It's a great title for a book, isn't it? The Christian Salt and Light Company. This is what he says with regards to the Sermon on the Mount. He says, if anger was the real issue of murder, and lust the real issue of adultery, and selfishness the real issue of divorce, then deceit is the real issue of oaths. And he goes on to add that Jesus wasn't addressing whether or not we should take an oath. He was talking about whether or not we are truthful. We don't tell the truth because we take an oath. We tell the truth because that's who we are. Truthful people. It has to come from the heart. And truthful communication is essential for good relationships, because truth is essential for trust. And if you don't trust someone, you're not going to allow that person to get close to you and to develop and to build a relationship. We lie and we deceive others because we mistakenly think that that will hold the relationship together. And so we rationalize bending the truth, thinking that if this person really knew the truth about me, they'd never speak to me again. And if they really knew what I'm like, then our relationship would be over. But you know, that's really like trying to fix a broken pipe with masking tape. You know, you'll slow down the leak temporarily, but you're only going to delay the disaster. The pipe eventually is going to burst, and it's going to cause far more damage than if you'd fixed it properly in the first place when the leak was first detected. So if we practice, for example, deception in our marriages, you know, we may preserve a superficial peace on the surface, but underneath the surface, there's going to be a volcano that is building up. And when the truth is revealed, that volcano will erupt, and it will cause far more damage than if we honestly dealt with the root issues when they first came up. And the same thing is true in the rearing of our children. If we deceive them, if we tell them one thing while you are living in a completely different way, at some point they're going to see through that deception, and at some point they're going to say, I don't want to know the God that you are saying you're following, because you're not living out what you're saying. You see, it's far better to live with integrity, confessing where we've gone wrong, asking for forgiveness from our family where we've gone wrong, because then they'll see a reality in the walk that you're having with Jesus. And they'll be far more inclined to follow you, to walk alongside you, to be building a close relationship with you, than if they see that there is hypocrisy and deception in your life. Take a look over in Psalm 15. Psalm chapter 15, we'll begin in verse 1. And in verse 1, the psalmist says, Lord, who may dwell in your sacred tent? Who may live on your holy mountain? The one whose walk is blameless, who does what is righteous, who speaks the truth from their heart. You see, that's what the issue is here. Out of our heart we will speak. And the psalmist is saying we need to speak truth from our heart. Whose tongue utters no slander, who does no wrong to a neighbour and casts no slur on others. Who despises a vile person but honours those who fear the Lord. Who keeps an oath, even when it hurts, and does not change their mind. Now, that psalm is quite interesting because I'm sure all of us want to dwell in God's sacred tent. We all want to live on his holy mountain. And if we want to have that kind of close and intimate relationship with God, then there are some tongue issues that need to be resolved. That's what the psalmist is saying. You need to speak the truth from your heart. Don't slander, don't cast a slur on others, and significantly, keep an oath even when it hurts, and don't change your mind. See, it's not wrong to make an oath, but if you do, then you need to really consider that you've got to keep it. You can't just change your mind willy-nilly, whenever you want to, even at great pain and cost to yourself. And then it says in verse 5, whoever does these things will never be shaken. You see, in our Christian walk, we must endeavour to work at having truthful communication, and that involves for us being aware of some of the pitfalls that we can fall into along the way. Now here are a few traps that we can all easily fall into. The half-truth. You ever given the half-truth? You know, you tell the truth, but it's just not all of the truth. Now, Abraham did that with claiming that Sarah was his sister. Well, yeah, it was his half-sister. Oh, he just didn't mention the fact that she was his wife as well. And then there's the white lie. Ever told a white lie? It's not as serious as a black lie, is it? A white lie is all right. It's just an innocent lie. Nobody gets hurt, do they? Call in sick at work when really I'm all right? That type of thing. What about the lie to cover for someone else? He's not in. When really he is in, but he just doesn't want to speak to you. What about exaggeration? stretching the truth a little bit just to make yourself look better or to invoke some sympathy for your cause. What about the silent lie? You know, someone else assumes something rather flattering about you and goes around saying it, but you know it's not true. You know it's false. But you don't step in and correct it, you just let it carry on. It's rather nice, isn't it? People saying all these nice things about me, it's not actually true. Or the cover-up lie. You know, you hide your wrongdoing with the rationalisation that it would hurt the other person if they knew the real truth. It's going to cover it up. Or the evasive lie. You know, you change the subject rather conveniently to dodge the truth. Have you done any of those? I know I have. And if we're honest and we're not lying to ourselves, we've probably all lied in many, if not all, of those ways at some time or another. But if we have, then don't fret. Because if Abraham lied about Sarah, and David lied about Bathsheba, and Peter lied about knowing Jesus, none of us are exempt from this temptation to sin in this way. And the same, none of us are exempt from being restored to walking truthfully with God. None of us. You see, the Spirit of truth can heal our tongues and our mouths so that we can be people of truthful communication. But we have to surrender to Him, we have to be open to His guidance, and we have to keep in step with the Spirit. And that means not wandering off in front of where the Spirit is leading, and it also means not lagging behind where the Spirit is leading. We need to keep in step with Him and make sure that we don't quench the work that He is doing. Now, can we commit to speaking the truth from our heart?